We'll do one. Twice. We could do it loud enough so the light turns on if you hit it hard enough.
Hard enough to crack walnuts.
Okay, House Judiciary Committee meeting is in order. It's whatever time it is, it's after one. Monday, April 11th, President R. Representative Keller, Representative Pruitt, Representative Gruenberg, Vice Chair Thompson, Chair Gatto, which means we've got a couple of missing members. Hopefully they'll show up. First thing is housekeeping, cell phones. If your cell phone is on and it goes off, you're in trouble. Three bills in front of us, House Bill 15, Student Athlete Traumatic Brain Injuries, HJR 16, Constitutional Amendment Education Funding, and House Bill 224, Sales of Nicotine Products to a Minor. We'll begin with House Bill 15, Student Athlete Traumatic Brain Injuries, sponsored by Representative Dugan and his capable staffer, Frank Amaduri. You have the floor, sign in, and we'll start. We're joined by Representative Lynn, for the record.
Really quick before he starts, Mr. Chairman.
Say again?
Just one.
Okay.
And if you would, Representative Dugan, also explain, since I was in education, understand that it originally had a referral to another committee and why the committee decided to choose it here, if you guys wouldn't mind, so that they understand why we're hearing it here. I think that would help.
That'd be fine.
I've racked my mind for it.
We've noticed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mike Dugan. I represent House District 25 in Anchorage. And I want to thank you for hearing this bill. To speak to the question that was just posed, this bill originally had a referral to health and but because of some questions about a particular provision in the bill, it was decided to move to this committee, and because it only had two already, it was decided to strike the Hess referral and bring it instead into this committee. And so that's the sort of the procedure that was followed. Is that?
Well, and what I wanted to get into is just if you would touch on, there were some concerns about legality to the schools. Implication it had to the schools, which is why they decided it had more of a importance by coming to see us here in Judiciary than health, because we understand the health aspect. It was the
and for the record, Representative Holmes has joined the committee. We now have a full membership at the table. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some prepared remarks. I don't actually have to deliver them, even though I'm sure it would be fascinating for everyone. And on this particular question, if it wouldn't be a problem, I'd like Frank to speak a little bit about this so that everybody knows what happened and why.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Frank Amaduri, and I am staff to Representative Dugan. And yes, in the Education Committee, there was at least one member who wasn't clear about some of the liability language, which you'll find on the last page of the bill, starting at around line 10. And for the sake of simplicity, I'll just say that and I believe Representative Holmes on the committee can probably speak to this more clearly than I can, but
you're talking page 3, line 10?
Yes, sir. And all of the liability language in the bill essentially reduces liability. As we stand right now, without any law, regulation, or guidelines in the state about concussions, in essence, liability for a district or for someone contracting with the district is essentially at 100%, and they could be sued simply because there are no guidelines. All of the liability language in this bill simply says, if you know the rules, if you follow the rules, your liability is reduced or eliminated. This particular section was put in because in Alaska, some schools, almost every school really, contracts with nonprofit organizations to do some of their sports. And one good example is not just in Alaska, but in almost every state, you've got American Legion Baseball. The school season ends because it's in the, you know, in the springtime, and then it continues through a contract with American Legion. And all this language simply says is as long as American Legion or whatever other organization is carries the proper insurance, and as long as they follow the provisions of these guidelines, they also are extended the immunity that is implicit for the schools in the rest of the bill. And if I could just real quickly, all those guidelines are is that what the bill does is it simply says teachers, coaches, parents, and students have to be educated about what a concussion is, how to recognize one, and what should be done if you believe a student has received one. It says that the student cannot be returned. They have to be removed from play when they're suspected of receiving an initial concussion, and they're not allowed to return to play until a qualified medical professional releases them back to play. And so all the liability language does is say, as long as you do those things, whether you're the school district or whether you're an independent contractor working for the school district, as long as you do all of that, your liability is released.
Thank you. Thank you for covering that. That's why it's here. So,
yeah. Jumping up to page 3, line 7, middle of the thing, may not be held liable for civil damages resulting from an act or omission during the evaluation, except that the person may be held liable for reckless or intentional misconduct. I was thinking, despite all sports like bowling or where head injuries almost don't occur, where they have to follow the guidelines because it's a sport.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And in fact, I mean, it's funny you mentioned that one because someone that I was talking to about the bill, you actually could get one in bowling by slipping as you go across the foul line and banging your head on the floor. Mm-hmm. Oddly, that came up in a discussion about this. But yes, it would apply to all sports. One thing to mention real quickly there as well is that one of the things that the bill recognizes is that you really can't protect anyone from an initial concussion. Kids are going to climb trees. Kids are, you know, in any sport that you participate in, even football where they have extensive safety equipment, that doesn't protect you from an initial concussion. What this bill does is remove the kid from play at that point so that he or she doesn't receive a second concussion, which could result in permanent brain damage and very debilitating.
Cross-country runner, I don't
know. Hits their head on a branch.
Slips on a branch, looks at the finish line less than a mile away. I'm fine. Can't do it. It's not their choice.
Although, I mean, Mr. Chairman, part of the problem is that you, an adult who knows how to recognize this, does have to see it happen. But it's everyone's responsibility, even the parents. If they suspect the child of having a concussion, it's anybody's responsibility who's there to insist that they be removed from
play. I was thinking volleyball, but two people at lunch toward this, you know, the net. That has to happen occasionally. Representative Thompson.
Yes, thank you. Out of curiosity, on page 2 of the bill, line 23, you say students who are under 18 years of age, they have to sign a receipt. Line 25, if they're suspected of having a concussion, they have to be removed from the game. Why under 18? There's many seniors in high school that turn 18 in October or November of their senior year. They're 18 years of age playing a high school sport, and yet you're eliminating them from having to sign or to be removed from a game if they have a suspected head injury? That's the way I read it.
Through the speaker, to the chair, if I might. That's only for who is able to sign the release. So if the student is under 18, the parent or guardian needs to sign. But if the student is over 18, they are an adult, and then they can sign.
That makes sense.
Can or must? If you're over 18, do you have to have the 18-year-old signature?
Yes.
Not moms or dads. Got it. Okay. Representative Grunberg.
I have several questions.
Oh, good.
You are now coaches of the vicious team. V and U, vicious and unscrupulous. And Lance Pruitt is a star wide receiver.
Appreciate that.
You're just for a little while, because you're about to get a head injury.
I'm about to get a head
injury. And it's a tight game, and Crazy Legs over there has been running like crazy, catching everything in sight and some that are out of sight. And somebody hits him. As the coaches of V and U, do you have standing to have him removed under sub C?
Through the chair to Representative Grunberg. Standing, and we're required to do so. You be vicious, I'll be
so
unscrupulous.
So you now are not only vicious and unscrupulous, but you're legally educated. And so you're going to go, and you're going to watch this guy, and if he's hit anywhere near his head,
call it.
You're going to get to the ref, and you're going to say, I suspect him of having a concussion. I want him out of there. Are you sure you want that to allow that to be used for that type of behavior, or do you want to limit the standing to somebody on his team? Otherwise, these guys, particularly if they're seeking a future job with the Green Bay Packers and they want to impress those homegrown, those guys, or who's ever over there now, they're going to look for this people, and if they touch him on the helmet, they're going to say, he's suspected, I want him out. I don't think you want to have that used for that kind of stuff. Maybe you want to limit standing or something. That was my first comment, question.
So, Lawyer Frank? Which we have Lawyer Holmes.
Representative Grunberg through the chair. I have to be honest, our primary intent for this legislation is to protect kids from serious brain trauma. And I understand that sometimes in high school sports there are unscrupulous people who might try to misuse a rule that way. I would also suspect that there would be a heated discussion about it, that it would probably be left to the coach of that student, because that's ultimately where the liability lies.
I look at Representative Grunberg's comments. Every quarterback sneak just is going to bury the quarterback in there somewhere, and somebody's going to say, oh, man, our helmets collided. Take us both out.
To the chair and Rep. Grunberg, part of the training for this is to recognize symptoms. It's not just if you get hit in the head, but rather that you exhibit symptoms of a concussion. And there's an online training program available, and it's complete with videos and so on. You can get it at the CDC. You can also get it through the state of Washington's School Athletic Association. And one of the things about that is that people from Washington and from the National Football League worked on some of the material for that training packet. And one of the requirements they had was that it not be copyrighted, so it can be used by anyone. And I believe I can't speak for ASAA, but I believe that's a lot of the material they're going to use for their training program. It takes about 10 minutes, but it does require you to assess the student and assure that they do exhibit symptoms of a concussion before removing.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And I hope you don't mind following up here for a minute. The question was a serious one. It's a question. Many questions before this committee and in the law devolve onto the issue of, as my administrative law professor said, who decides? And under sub C, which is the strategic crux of this to those of us who love V and U and their coaching staff, is the issue of removal an issue that is up to the referee so that they could appeal to the ref? You're saying that it's up to the home coach to decide that. That's where the decision is made.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, in fact, it's up to any adult present at the game who has received this training. And the intent is to err on the side of caution for the student's health and safety.
Having been involved in the most, if I may, the most political position I ever had in my young life was when I was the vice president of the Anchorage Figure Skating Club. And I would never do that again. It involved mothers fighting over ice time. And if you leave it up to, quote, anybody who's been trained, you're going to have viciously partisan parents. I just think you need to, I'm not sure what you want to do with this, but otherwise it could be used to just remove kids.
Well, the next thing I want to do is take a question from Representative Holmes.
Not a question so much, Mr. Chairman, as weighing in on this point. Sub A of this same section, it starts on page 2, line 13, requires that guidelines be developed. And they are to be developed by the governing body of a school district in consultation with the ASAA to publish, develop and publish the guidelines and other information. So I would think, and I'm sympathetic to where Representative Grunberg's going, I played girls' club soccer and I played, you know, varsity sports through junior high and high school. I understand this. To some extent, I would think that would be developed in the guidelines by the ASAA and the governing bodies of the school districts.
An interesting point. Soccer is a game where you use your head.
You do.
No helmets.
And sometimes multiple people use their heads at the same time attempting to hit the same ball.
Yes. under the rules of soccer, that's interesting because it happens so often in soccer.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when the goalie, the keeper, has kicked the ball halfway down the field and somebody leaps up into the ball and uses his head to send it halfway back. Holy smokes, that is...
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's the problem. I think it's two people going for the ball at the same time with their heads where most of the problems occur in soccer.
My son played soccer and must have had a head injury. He's now a stockbroker. May I ask another question?
Well, my son played soccer, but he was the keeper.
Safer. Mr. Chairman, if I might speak to this point, it's not the purpose of the maker of this bill to try to ensure that nobody ever gets hurt playing in a sport, because, frankly, you'd hardly know it to look at me, but I used to play sports. I got hurt relatively frequently. I'm not going to talk about the number of concussions I got.
or what that might explain.
But there's the only way that we can do that, the only way that we can do that is to ban the sports, and it's not the intention of this bill to do that. We're trying to strike a balance between people being able to play these sports and making sure that if someone does get a head injury, which is peculiarly dangerous, I would say, in terms of the kinds of injuries that people can get, that if they get a concussion, that there's a procedure for making sure that they have recovered from that before they're allowed to play again. And that's simply it. It's not trying to some sort of wrap all athletes in cotton wool and make sure that they never get hurt. Thank you. Bubble wrap. Thank you. I'm showing my age.
Mr. Amaduri.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, in your packet, you'll find the information and education packet somewhere in there. And one of the pages in there explains two different columns. One is signs observed by parents or guardians, and the other is symptoms reported by athletes. And so these are just to be clear on how the process works, these are the things that you're looking for. So it's not just if a kid falls down and bangs his head or someone smacks their heads together in soccer. Some signs or symptoms have to be observed. And so among them are appears dazed or stunned, is confused about assignment or position, forgets an instruction, is unsure of game score or opponent. So there's continues to be, is that not?
What does it look like?
Well, the pages that I'm looking at looks like this.
Okay. Heads up.
Heads up?
Heads up, yeah.
It's quite a, I don't see. Okay. Okay, I guess.
If it's not there, I'll
provide. No, Gretchen, I guess it's got it.
About two-thirds.
It was more than two pages, so she didn't come. All right. No pictures.
Supporting backup.
And that's just a few of the, probably near, it looks like maybe 10 or so on that side. On the other side are the symptoms reported by an athlete, which include things like headache or pressure in the head, nausea or vomiting, balance problems or dizziness, concentration or memory problems. There's a whole raft of those as well. And so it's not just that someone would suspect that there may be a concussion. There actually are some things that they're required to look for, and that should be exhibited before the student is removed from play. So just to be clear on that, that it couldn't just be the opposing coach saying, hey, it looked like he or she got hit pretty good there. We better take him out. There's a lot more to it than that.
I'm going to make a comment here. Back when I was a medic, we dealt with epidurals and subdurals. And the thing about subdurals is they're slow bleeds, and you could wind up being in bed at night and can't wake you up. They come on slow. The cranial vault is rigid. When you start bleeding into it, pushes the brain away, and nothing short of a hole drilled in your skull and draining out the blood is really going to relieve that pressure. Works, but and then cauterize the pain. But those were important, even though on the field nobody picked up on it.
Mr. Chair, at the risk of being of overstepping my bounds, there actually are a couple people online to testify who are much better at describing this than I am.
Yeah, but it's our chance to put you in the barrel.
But I may need to be removed from the game. I'm feeling pressure behind.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gruenberg.
I was thinking under symptoms reported, it says by athlete. I would cross that out and say symptoms reported at end of legislative session.
Okay. Any more questions from the committee?
I have some questions, but maybe you want to do it after everybody testifies.
There are some really interesting people online that are willing to testify. Yeah. I think it would add measurably to our committee conversation once we had all that testimony. Sure. So I'm going to start right out with Stanley Herring. Dr. Stanley Herring, are you online?
Yes, I'm on the phone.
You're on the phone. Great. It says here you're with the NFL.
Yes, I'm at the University of Washington and in practice as a professor there, but I am on the NFL Head, Neck, and Spine Committee, the newly formed Concussion Committee.
Okay, I'm going to guess you have a substantial amount of testimony you could give us, so go ahead.
Oh, listen, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I came on the phone call just a few minutes ago. I'm trying to this is important, and I wanted to get on the phone, so I'm sorry I didn't hear all the testimony preceding it, but maybe I can see if I can help you folks get to where we are and then answer any questions that you may have, because I think that what you folks are doing here is important and critical in terms of keeping sports safe. The state of Washington passed the Zachary Leistat Law, as probably everybody in your room knows, and that was the first law in the nation that really addressed this with the three core principles that you folks have been discussing in your bill. So I have the luxury of having worked very diligently on that legislation, having legislation now of a similar nature passed in 15 more states, and also having the hindsight to see how it's been enacted since July 2009. So I have experience, and perhaps that will answer some of the questions that are raised.
Well, right off the bat, we've been discussing head injuries and neglected completely neck and spine injuries. may not have even thought about them until I saw what your affiliation was.
Right, we sort of think they're all connected, and certainly the same protocols and safety that are followed for suspected brain injury will also remove an athlete with a suspected spine injury from play, so you get value that way in both circumstances. We have seen that coaches, parents, and athletes, when educated, actually become fairly good advocates for trying to help keep sports safe when they understand the consequences of potentially playing with a concussion. I heard the question or the comment about a subdural. It's often not the first blow, but repeated blows in the presence of a small venous tear that result in a subdural. I'm happy to report that since the Zachary Lastet law was passed in the state of Washington, for the first time in five seasons during football, there has not been a subdural hematoma now in the state of Washington. So we do feel that by getting everybody on the same page, we've been able to make sports safer. We have not had trouble with coaches on the opposing team pulling players for the same reasons you talked about. There has to be symptoms. Coaches also have to reply to their organization that governs and licenses them, so aberrant behavior that way probably would not be tolerated. What we have seen are coaches relieved that they have the burden of having to return a player to play. We've also seen a better awareness by parents and athletes, and even athletes now reporting on other players on their own team about whom they're concerned. So I'm happy to report that the parts of your conversation I caught were the same concerns and worries that we have, but I'm happy to report that our experience now and the experience in other states that have passed similar legislation has been awareness, proper attention to a injury that can prevent significant and serious trauma, even death if mismanaged, and no diminishment, decrease, or lack of participation or interest in contact or collision sport.
Okay, when you said there were no reported subdurals, does that mean none occurred, or that you did identify some and treat them, and therefore they didn't develop into a serious?
We were able to stop athletes from continuing to participate in a role that would cause them to have a subdural hematoma. In other words, the early reporting of a suspected concussion removes the athlete before he or she takes a second, third, or fourth blow. Often that is the blow which causes the bleeding to break loose. Every year in the state of Washington, for the past 5 years, actually until the law was passed, there was at least one subdural hematoma during football season. This last season, there were none.
Well, it's 100% reduction.
You can prevent preventable brain injury.
Anyone have some questions for Dr. Herring? Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. speaking as a lawyer to you, Dr. Herring, through the chair, is the term concussion sufficiently defined in the common law that we don't need a definition here? If you're familiar, it sounds like you are, with the other laws on the subject, do any of them define the term concussion? And if so, what definition do you recommend?
Thank you, Representative. No other law has felt it necessary to spell out the definition of concussion. Many laws have similar language to the bill of yours to which I am referring now that was sent to me, where it talks about how a concussion occurs, but it has not been felt necessary to define it any further. Actually, the idea being that if there's even a suspicion that a concussion has occurred, the safest thing to do is just to remove the player. So when in doubt, sit them out. But it is not, no one, we have not had, in the states that have passed the law, no more definitive language than the language in your bill has been present.
May I follow up with a different question, please?
Go ahead.
Dr. Herring, through the chair, you probably heard my discussion with Representative Dugan and Mr. Amadouri on the provision that is, do you have a copy of the bill handy?
I do, yes.
It's on page 2, lines 25 and 26. It doesn't specify who has the authority to remove the student from the game and whether that has ever been used as a tactical ploy. Has that been a problem?
It has not been a problem. The question has been raised. And like I say, we did get the question about could an unscrupulous coach claim the opposing starting quarterback or best player on the soccer team had a concussion to form a competitive advantage. That has not happened. It's also been our experience that coaches themselves have their own organizations that allow them to coach. They either the Interscholastic Activities or some association or some other organization that gives them permission to coach. And that we thought that would certainly be a cause to look at their ability to continue to coach if they were to pull such a shenanigan. It has not been a problem. Actually, the contrary is the coaches of the players, their own coach, those coaches have been very interested in understanding this because no coach wants to hurt his or her athlete. So we've, with the CDC materials and materials that we've developed and are available on our Interscholastic website for free, the coaches have become avid students, but we have not seen their interest misused.
And finally, I have one more question, Mr. Chair. Page 3, line 8, is a civil immunity statute, resulting from an act or omission during the evaluation. I suppose I had misread it a minute ago when I read the bill really for the first time. Is that broad enough? Because what we're saying that the act or omission, or failure to act, really, it's omission, must have occurred during the evaluation. Do you believe, from what you've seen as a practicing physician, that that provides you with sufficient immunity? I can't think of a hypothetical. Maybe the other attorney on the committee or somebody else can think of a circumstance where civil damages action could be brought against the person conducting the evaluation. And I guess it would have to be from an act or omission during the evaluation. I can't think of any factual pattern that would be to the contrary. Has that been a problem through the chair, Dr. Herring?
I will defer to your legal interpretation of the language. I have seen this language in other bills, and I think it's there for the same reason you thought of. I don't believe anyone could pierce that veil or poke a hole in that, and it has not been a problem, this sort of indemnification of a volunteer. This, once again, is language I've seen in other legislative efforts, and as you might imagine, here in the state of Washington, our bill was under heavy sort of review and written by attorneys, and this is similar language to in the Washington state bill, I believe.
And I would just, one other thing I thought. I'm trying to pick up any of the issues I can because this is the committee to do it. I was such a bad swimmer that they said I could either practice with the team and never get in a meet or be the manager and get a letter as the manager, so I chose to manage. And I managed in college and got a letter in college, too, for that. But I was a yell leader. I wasn't one of these guys who jumped around. I was the head yeller who naturally led the cheers back when they had the megaphones and that kind of stuff. This is dealing with athletes. And I'm wondering, are people who are cheerleaders and stuff and jump around and stuff, I guess that's now considered a form of athleticism. I don't know, but are they covered? I see we have Mr. Amadouri. I'd ask one of you, are people like cheerleaders covered?
Through the chair to Representative Grunberg, if I might, just real quickly. Again, Frank Amadouri, staff to Rep. Dugan. One of the interesting points there, and for the purposes of the bill, the answer is no. This only deals with athletes. However, we had visits from the school members of the School Nurses Association and also the State Association of Nurses or something like that, who said that if the bill passes, the School Nurses Association said they would be interested in approaching the school districts and having these same rules apply to students in general, you know, even on the playground. Or things like that. And also, anecdotally, and I believe the people online from Washington can probably back this up, in other states where they've passed these laws, the law tends to, or the rules tend to be applied at all levels, even outside of the school districts. For instance, club sports, you know, club soccer teams and things like that begin to adopt the rules simply because they make sense. And as Dr. Herring mentioned, they have incredibly good results in terms of preventing those additional concussions and serious brain injury. The experience so far from everything that I've seen and people that I've talked to is that the protections tend to expand once the law is in place. Maybe Dr. Herring can respond.
I would ask both Mr. Amadouri on behalf of the sponsor any recommendation by Dr. Herring, should we include other things in this, or do you want to leave it just narrowly?
We have a few more people that have some pretty good credentials that will be able to add immeasurably to the conversation here. So, and we have Ken Edwards or Ken Edmonds. I have it spelled both ways. Are you online?
It's Ken Edmonds, and I'm also with the National Football League. I'm here to answer any questions that the committee may have, although while we have Dr. Herring on the line, I would certainly defer to the doctor for any medical questions that you have. I'm pleased that he's been able to take time out of his busy schedule to join us this afternoon. He's our leading expert in this area, and I want to make sure that we take full advantage of his expertise while he's with the committee, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman.
No, good idea. You're with public policy. Is that correct?
That's right. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Public Policy for the NFL.
And under public policy, does it deal with the specifics of head injuries, or is it we need to do something about head injuries?
Well, we are certainly active in other states, and our main objective is to help states pass Lystedt-type laws, and so we're pleased to be testifying with you today, and we're active in a number of other states working with advocates and medical experts to make sure that they pass similar laws in their state. So from a public policy standpoint, that is our goal. And this law is very similar to the Lystedt law in that it contains three core principles that Dr. Herring mentioned, and that is education to make sure that youth athletes as well as parents and guardians and school officials are educated about the risks of concussions as well as their signs. And the second of the core principles is to make sure that youth athletes who are suspected of sustaining a concussion are immediately removed from player practice. And the third, of course, which is also contained in this legislation, is to make sure that students are not allowed to return to play until that they receive medical evaluation and clearance from a professional healthcare provider who is trained in the management and evaluation of concussions. And so we're pleased to support this bill because it contains all three of those principles, and so we'd like to see it pass as soon as possible because we know the impact that it's had in Washington State and all the other states that have enacted the law since 2009.
Just curious, are we behind with no laws, or and how many states actually have what's equivalent to the Washington State policy?
Well, 13 states have adopted the law, and as Dr. Herring mentioned, Washington State was the first to pass it in 2009. Oregon, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, recently Colorado and Nebraska and South Dakota have passed the law, but Alaska would certainly be among the first 20 states to pass this law, and so you would be certainly in the forefront of protecting the youth athletes in your state.
Appreciate that. Does that conclude your testimony except for questions as they come up?
It does.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg has a question.
Somewhere here it says that that somebody is, I must be looking at the wrong version of the bill. Yeah, I'm sorry, looking at the wrong version, I couldn't find it. Okay, here at the top of page 3, this is to Dr. Herring. Qualified person means either a healthcare provider who's licensed or, and this is what I'm focusing
on. Which line are you on the top of
I'm on page 3 lines 3 through 5. a person who's acting under the direction and under the supervision of a physician who's licensed in the state. Dr. Herring and other folks, we are one-fifth the size of the United States, have half the coastline, and we would stretch from literally from coast to coast if we were placed roughly on a map. In many rural areas, they play sports. Basketball, for example, is played in every town, hamlet, and village across this huge state. And there are very few physicians. And we've got, if we're lucky, health aides in the village. And to require that each of these kids be evaluated by either somebody who's a health care provider who's licensed or exempt by licensure, may, if they're lucky, get the health aide in there. But a person who's acting at the direction or under the supervision of a physician is going to make it very, very difficult in the bush. And if I'll pass. You get the gist of my question. We see Mr. Amadouri.
Amadouri ready to answer.
To Representative Grunberg through the chair. Yes, there were two changes that were made from the original bill, both represented there at the top of page 3. One of the changes was done through amendment in the Education Committee, which is the addition of the line in line 1 that says, or exempt from licensure, and that simply refers to doctors who essentially are visiting the state and probably are in rural areas, and they are exempt while they're here because they're able to use their license from their other state. In the second section there, number 2 at line 3, that was added in a CS before we brought it to the Education Committee for the very reason that you mentioned. And the problem is that, as you pointed out, in rural areas, which of course, as we know in Alaska, are not only rural but often remote as well, they don't have access to a physician in every town or village. But they usually do have either a village nurse or a village health aide. And so this covers those people who do work under the direction of a physician. And that's why it was intentionally added there, to add accessibility to the best of our ability. Unfortunately, we can't solve all of the challenges in rural Alaska, but this actually solves most of them. It also helps a group of people that I believe there are about 40 of them right now in the state that are the certified athletic trainers who actually are educated in this very sort of thing, but they're not yet licensed in Alaska. They also work under the direction of a physician in certain cases, and this would allow them to also perform this service of releasing students back to play. So what we did there was try to expand accessibility as much as possible without endangering the kids, you know, making sure that we still had qualified people doing those evaluations.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That comforts me.
Out in the bush, we have kids playing a lot on four-wheelers, can easily turn one over, land on their head. Are they considered in this bill?
To the chairman, actually, no, unless they're, you know, performing four-wheeler competitions in school. And this specifically addresses school districts in conjunction, well, forming the guidelines with ASAA. But as I said, I mean, a lot of communities, a lot of club sports and those sorts of things begin to adopt these very regulations. Certainly, if in a case like that, it would simply be the same as it is now. It would be up to the parents or guardian to make that call.
Question?
Mr. Chair.
We have a few more people.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Mr. Chair, just let me put in my final question on the record here, and it's more of a technical question. The other major question I had here, and at some point somebody can answer this. On line 10, the final section, 1430.143, it doesn't seem to be limited to concussive injuries, and it seems to be a general immunization, although in the tagline, which isn't part of the bill, on line 10 it says concussions in student athletes. but it doesn't have, like on line 11, a school district may not be held liable for a concussive injury or to the death of a person resulting from a, say, the action or inaction, blah, 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 which caused a concussion. And at some point, I'm wondering whether we should have an amendment to limit it to concussions, because that's what the rest of the bill relates to.
Do you have an answer?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair. I don't, other than because it's in the title, concussions in student athletes, school district immunity. And, I would have to defer to the legal minds. And
I'd probably allow for an amendment at that time. Not because I don't want to expand it, but if we're going to expand it, we should cross the board. And I'll just do that at the appropriate time.
Yeah. Jean Michelle, are you online?
Yes, I am.
And you're with Legal Services. Did you catch Representative Grunberg's question on concussions?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chairman. The provision on lines 22 to 23 requires that the protocols and preventions be provided under 1430-142. So if that protocol is provided, then those individuals won't be held liable, and I can't think of a time where the protocol would be complied with and provided for any other activity. But we could certainly add a couple of words up on line 11 if the representative finds that ambiguous.
I think I'd like to do that at the appropriate time.
We'll just wait for that. And you're available for further questions?
Yes, I am.
Appreciate that. Let's go to Jill Hodges, Alaska Brain Injury Network. Jill, are you online?
I am, yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Well, you're a little far away. Can you get up tighter with the microphone? It would help.
I actually am speaking directly into the microphone. I think our phones are just quiet.
Well, that's a blessing. Yeah, well, your voice now sounds right in the middle range of being really adequate.
Okay, great. Well, I'll try to speak up. Thank you. My name is Jill Hodges, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Brain Injury Network. We're located here in Anchorage, but we serve as the statewide Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Board, working with the state and the Mental Health Trust Authority, as well as an information and referral agency where people who are Alaskans across the state call us when they're looking for more brain injury information or services. And I've been trying to listen in. I wasn't able to hear all the questions, but I think all the questions that I did hear are very valid, and I'm really proud that our legislature is considering so many details of this bill to make it the best bill possible. The need for this bill is, as the doctor from Washington spoke to, and also the NFL, once you meet somebody who's been impacted by a concussion that the second impact was devastating, this bill makes complete sense across the board. I've heard testimony from 18-year-olds, 21-year-olds from across the U.S. who said, you know, they're like 23, 24 now. They're getting through college, but they wish that they would have had a little bit more information when they were in high school when they suffered that concussion. And they spent years trying to get back to where their once ambitions were. Many of our student athletes are exceptional human beings and have a lot of potential to do very well in business or in medicine or in the legislature. And we really want to help them get to or to help them meet their goals. Here at the Brain Injury Network, we have spoken to over 800 Alaskans who have suffered a traumatic brain injury in the past 4 years. And across the board, either a concussion, mild injury, moderate or severe, which are all medical terms, TBI is prevalent across all age groups. It's really hard right now to track how many student athletes are suffering concussions, but we do have an estimate that there are 3,000 Alaskans of all ages going to the emergency department each year for a concussion or mild traumatic brain injury. We also know there's about 800 Alaskans that are actually hospitalized on top of that 3,000, for a more moderate to severe injury, meaning that they're in the hospital for more than 24 hours. Here in Alaska, we actually do not have a multidisciplinary approach to treating traumatic brain injury. So the more serious injuries, most people fly to Harborview in or seek care in the lower 48. Concussions are very straightforward. I mean, not straightforward, but once you learn to recognize a concussion, it becomes very evident. When the child is a little bit disoriented, can't quite remember the plays, just kind of has this funny look in their eyes, they can't see quite right, it's definitely a huge sign that they might have rung their bell hard enough that a concussion took place. And from the 18, 19, 20-year-olds that I've heard from, and as a college athlete myself at a Division I school, I wish that I would have the resources in my team and within my school to help recognize that maybe I should be sitting out for a few days. Because really, in the long run, a week, even 3 months, is a very short time period compared to losing your life or maybe not be able to return to sports again. And so the Alaska Brain Injury Network highly encourages that the Judiciary Committee support this bill. We really thank Representative Dugan for his leadership in bringing this to Alaska. We've worked very closely with Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and some of the other states that have implemented this bill. And as Frank shared, states are going above and beyond, and it really is infiltrating beyond the student athletes on the field to what they're doing on their bicycle and on their skateboards. Kids are starting to recognize, and parents are starting to recognize, that the brain is vulnerable and a concussion is serious, and that if we could prevent them on the field, we should be doing all that we can to prevent them off the field as well. So this is a good bill, we believe, for the state of Alaska in general to help get control over traumatic brain injury here, which has been seen as a silent epidemic and a public health crisis. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to offer answer any of your questions.
Thanks, Jill, for your testimony. Isn't it an axiom in medicine that it's terrible to re-injure an injury that has not yet healed, whether it's a brain injury or a broken elbow?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Sure. Isn't it an axiom in medicine that it's a terrible thing to do to re-injure an unhealed injury, whether it's in the brain or any place? It's just, and that's why we want to deal with this bill and get the kids off the field before they get a second concussion. And so if you already have a traumatized area and you hit it a second time, it's easy to multiply the effect, not just by two, but maybe by 10.
Well, this is Joe. I think Dr. Herring might be able to answer that.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, Representative, what you said is absolutely true. This is Stan Herring. The brain is particularly vulnerable until it recovers, and youth brains take longer to recover. And during that period of vulnerability, certain and unique things can happen to them that can be devastating, if not deadly. So this is particularly relevant for this injury and is particularly relevant for youth athletes. So, yes, there is. It's not the first blow. It's the second or third blow. So you have a chance here to prevent preventable brain injury.
Thank you. Let me go to the last person in the room here, Bruce Johnson. Bruce Johnson's with ACSA? Okay, Bruce, go ahead and check in and give us your affiliation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bruce Johnson, I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Council of School Administrators, and we represent superintendents, principals, and school business officials. We've been working closely with the sponsor of the bill, as well as the sponsor of the bill in the other body, to get this to a point where we can lend our full support. And I'd also like to add that the School Board Association has also been working, even though they're not here today because of a conflict, that they've been working in conjunction with us as well to ensure that this bill comes out in a way that will work well for the student-athlete. First and foremost, we're about safety, not winning games necessarily. Winning games is secondary. And we want adequate protections and protocols and those sorts of things to be absolutely sure that everyone follows kind of the letter of the law and the letter of those protocols. So we would like to lend our support. There's a couple slight differences between the two bodies, and I'm assuming that those things can be worked out as we move forward.
Are you satisfied with the current language in the bill?
We're satisfied with the exception in line 30 on page 2, where it says it currently certified in evaluation and management of concussions. Our legal counsel that is actually the legal counsel for the Activities Association recommends that we put as verified in writing by the qualified person, so that you have, if you're on the sidelines making this choice to have somebody evaluate, we believe it's in the best interest of the school district and perhaps everyone involved that someone has to verify that they are, in fact, trained and the appropriate person to be making this very difficult decision. That language was approved in the other body.
I see your point.
On that point.
Dr. Herring? Did you catch that proposed amendment on page 2, line 30?
I think that's fine. Once again, I think that I circled this. I was going to ask you folks what you meant by certified. I think the language that you propose is helpful, and really what you want to do is you want to make sure that the person who is making the return to play decision has knowledge about the evaluation and management of concussion. And those resources, folks, are readily available. They're available now through different organizations, and the NFL is working with the Center for Disease Control, and by the end of this summer, we will have a freely available webinar for healthcare providers to watch that specifically address these issues as well.
Okay. Representative Gruenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The term, as verified in writing by the qualified person, the term verified has two different meanings. Meaning one is as proven or as supported. Another term is in ASO 963, which is a specific form of notarization. I think you mean it in the former rather than the latter. Through the chair, that's to Mr. Johnson. Am I right, sir?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I'm obviously not a legal person, but the former does sound as though that meets our intent.
Okay, and secondly, you're not requiring that they do this only by a notarized statement, but they could provide a certificate or something else as long as there's a written document for the file.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, yes, I think there would be probably many models, although I think that the Activities Association would develop a form for that purpose if that was available and those sorts of things so that that could be used.
And I have a question to follow up with Ms. Michelle on that point. Could I ask her a question?
Go ahead.
Ms. Michelle, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Did you copy down or do you hear the language, the amendment that's we're talking about as verified in writing by the qualified person?
Yes.
Okay. If it were sent as an electronic transmission via email, would that be within the term writing, or would we have to say in writing or electronically?
Through the chair, this is Jean Michelle again with Legal Services. I think it would have to be specified electronic. My question, though, is I'm not sure how verification by the qualified person provides any further reassurance. I think just proof of current certification provided to the district would be a better approach, but that's up to you.
Let me comment on that. Once again, as a medic, we would go to any number of traffic accidents, and I would say one out of 10 or 15, somebody would come over and say, I'm a doctor, and try to take over the scene. And we reached the point where we said, do you have some ID? And they'd say, I'm busy. And then you kind of guessed that they didn't. And say, well, I can't let you touch the patient until I see the ID. And if you won't move, I'll have the police remove you. And then they'd leave, which kind of verified the whole thing. So the verifiable issue to me is significant. Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're getting to the point of crafting this kind of a language. And I think, and this can be a conceptual amendment at the appropriate time, I'm not making it at the moment, but something to the effect of that where we're talking about certification, current certification on line 30, we could just have another sentence in there that says, current certification shall be by written or electronic
transmission
proof. Something like that. Miss Michelle, I think, we have some other witnesses and stuff, don't we? Oh, maybe we could just do a conceptual amendment at the appropriate time or something.
Well, this would be the time.
Are you, that's the end of the witnesses, huh?
That's the end of the witnesses, unless we have someone in the audience or someone else online that wants to testify. Is there anyone online or in the audience? Seeing and hearing none, closing public testimony. Representative Thompson?
Yes, on referencing page 2, those last few lines, it looks to me like that this is also could be used if there's suspicion of a head injury, that this could be used on the sidelines in order for that person to get back into the game. And I think that to try to make it where they have to have overly qualified information to certify them, this is what I worry about.
No, Mr. Chair, they're talking about proof that the person is qualified right to do it, and that would be on file in advance, as I understand it. Is that, where did Mr. Emmett, oh, there you are. That would be done in advance, right? Through the chair, Mr. Emmett.
At a high school football game?
No. You would have somebody who's qualified, and they would be on the sidelines, and then they would take a look. But this would be proof in advance that they've met the qualifications.
Rep. Greenberg, through the chair. Again, Frank Amaduri. In the case like that, I would assume it would be someone like one of those certified athletic trainers that I mentioned who would already probably be under contract with the school, paperwork on file. I would mention just one thing, and that is on this amendment, this was a place where they did make the amendment on the Senate side. It was offered in education on the House side, and we didn't make it there. One of our concerns about that, and again, at some point we're, you know, our intent is to make the two bills conforming, and hopefully it will move out of the House, and then, you know, we understand that if they're conforming, it would be easier on the Senate side. So our intent is to get to that point, but we do have some concerns about this one, and one of them is it seems that this is the sort of thing that could, and I think probably should, be done in their guidelines or bylaws. And one of the reasons that I'll mention for that is that where it says that school districts will work with ASAA to develop guidelines, one of the things that I assume when it says that is that each school district is going to work individually with them. And so the more details that we put in statute, it seems to me that it limits individual school districts in their ability to, in their flexibility with their guidelines. And one of the reasons that I'm concerned, and certainly the legal experts on the panel will probably be able to answer this certainly better than I can, but in this case, it seems like the liability is more perceived than actual, to be honest. And what it seems to me that what we're doing by doing this is shifting that perceived liability to the doctor or the medical person and away from the district. And one of my concerns there is that if you're in one of those rural communities where access is already limited and the doctor gets scared off from signing the document, that's going to limit accessibility for the student. I'm a little concerned about that. It may not be a big issue. And again, we're willing to work on this. My intent was to try and get through the House and then have the interim to work out the details. And I have been talking to Senator McGuire's office on the other side that's carrying the other bill that does have the amendment. We'd certainly be willing to go there. If possible, I would like to have a little more time to look into that, though, and see if it's too onerous for some districts, and then fix the problem as we're going through the Senate. So that would be my request.
So your choice is we set it aside until...
No, Mr. Chairman, my choice is you move it as is and we fix it in the Senate.
Representative Gruenberg?
With that, I will not offer that amendment, but I will offer the other conceptual amendment. Yeah, on page 3. And this is kind of, I'm just going to do conceptually. It's in lines 11 to 13, and the conceptually will be on line 11, where it says an injury, I would say a concussive. Oh. A concussive injury and or to the death of a person resulting from the action or inaction of a person employed by contract. It would be or to the death caused by concussion after death. Again, this is conceptual. Caused by a concussion of a person, and that would be my conceptual amendment.
And Representative Gruenberg, does the word concussion apply only above vertebrae number, the atlas, vertebrae number 1, or does it include the neck and the spine?
I'm going to tell you a story. My father used to say, you know, I went downtown and got a matter doc. And I would say, what's the matter, doc? And he'd say, I'm not a doctor, and I don't know what's the matter. Oh, and so I would defer to Dr. Herring to answer your question, because I'm not a doctor.
Okay, Dr. Herring?
He is no longer on.
Well, that answers that. Yeah. So we have a conceptual amendment?
Yeah, to say for a concussive injury, this is conceptual, or the death caused by a concussion, and with the understanding that, at least as far as I'm concerned, if your question can, if there's a problem that comes up later down the line, we can deal with it. But just so that we know that that section isn't a blanket exemption over everything, sprain toe.
Voice. I have to tell you, Frank, that it's not usually the policy of this committee to say, just leave it out, they'll fix it in the other body. If we did that, we could pass everything out and be gone in a half hour. So if a committee member wants to offer a conceptual amendment that would essentially agree with the Senate version, is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, that is true.
Do we need to vote on my amendment?
Oh yeah, we do. Is there an objection to the Gruenberg Amendment number 1?
Conceptual Amendment number 1.
Conceptual Amendment number 1. Seeing and hearing no objection, Conceptual Amendment number 1 is adopted. So if somebody wants to offer Amendment number 2, Representative Thompson.
Amendment number 2. No, I don't have an amendment.
I can try.
Okay, Representative Keller.
How about after on page 2? Line 30, right after the word certified, right to the satisfaction.
As verified in writing by a qualified person?
Yes. As currently certified to the satisfaction of the Alaska School Activities Association?
No, we were just saying a qualified person.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is the language.
Representative Holmes is saying, as verified in writing by the certified person instead of qualified?
You're probably the qualified person, you're right. Sorry, qualified person.
Okay, do you want to offer that one?
Where would this go?
30.
Page 2, line 30.
And After which word? Where does it go? After?
Certified.
After certified. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I offer...
Is it belong after management of concessions, period, and between concussions and period as verified in writing? Is that where it goes? I'm going to guess that's where it goes.
Mr. Chairman, if it's conceptual, legal can put it in the right place.
Conceptual amendment number two?
All right, conceptual amendment number two. Mr. Chairman, on page, I offer conceptual amendment number two. On page two, line 30, after the word certified, insert the words as verified in writing.
We don't have a word certified.
Yeah, fourth
one. Yes, you do.
Oh, there it is. Hidden. Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. So, after the word certified, insert the words as verified in writing by the qualified person.
Okay. I'm going to object for one moment here.
Moments up. Go ahead.
By the qualified person?
Qualified person.
Okay. In view of my question to Jean Michelle, she thought that electronically would... Yeah, I'd like to add after the word writing or electronically.
I'm
and ask if that would be a friendly amendment.
As verified in writing or electronically by a qualified person.
By the qualified person.
By the qualified person, okay? So that's amendment to amendment number two.
Amendment number one to amendment number two.
I remove my objection with the amendment to the amendment being adopted.
Okay. So we have the amendment to the amendment, and without objection, is there any other objection?
Just a discussion.
Representative Keller?
Is it clear, Representative Holmes, that we're talking about two separate qualified persons there?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, Representative Keller, Mr. Chairman, I think we're actually talking about the same certified person. I think...
That's why they use the word the.
Yeah, I think the intent is... I believe the intent, and I can be corrected if I'm wrong, is that if, say, I'm the certified person, I'm the qualified person. Sorry, we keep saying certified. I'm the qualified person. I'm the doctor or the health aide. And not only am I the one signing, evaluating, but then I'm also signing to say, and I actually do qualify as a qualified person under here. So that the school district doesn't just get a note from somebody and they have no knowledge about whether or not that person who signed it really is qualified under this section. So it actually would be the same person. I would be signing, Lindsay Holmes, am qualified under this section, and I am certifying that this person is okay to return to the sport. So I think it is the same person.
I understand that that's your language. I was confused in the testimony of Bruce, if that's what he intended.
Okay, good. Now we're all clear. thanks for clarifying.
My reference there was to Bruce Johnson.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And, and for the record, we're getting nods all the way around the room.
This is conceptual amendment number two we're dealing with now.
Mm-hmm. I remove my objection.
Objections removed. Wes Keller, did you have an objection?
Removed.
Objections are removed. Is there any other objection? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number two is adopted. We now, Representative Gruenberg.
This is more of a technical issue. If the members would, and this gets back to your question, which I couldn't answer, was an excellent question about where in the vertebrae this whole thing occurs. We have something here on page one, lines 12 through page two, line one. And I do not know, but these findings will appear in the notes at the end of the section, and it will state, because these are fairly long findings, that for legislative findings concerning concussions in student athletes, see the table of temporary acts. So they will not set them out at the end of the statute like my amendment would have done the other day. The people will have to take out their actual temporary act to see this. Now, this does not, I was looking at this as a definition of the term concussion. Dr. Herring said you don't need to define it, but this states how the concussion is caused. And I was going to leave it at that, but then the chair I think, raised the same question I had, whether it would, you know, the extent of what is a concussion, and as part of that, and whether or not something, a definition is put in. I would say, if you're thinking of putting in a definition, this should maybe, a concussion is blah, 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 and is caused by, and then moving this into the definitional section. I think because you're going to have this interpreted by lay people and coaches all over the state who aren't going to have any statutes hanging around.
Well, the point was that the brain is the processing center. You can be hurt anywhere in the spine. It goes up to the brain. The brain sends signals back down the spine, but that's where the injury is. Now, the brain's not injured, but the message transmission lines are down, even though the brain didn't get rattled around in the head. So that was the only issue. I'm not sure how common that is. I bet it happens, but the brain is probably the one that happens more severely and more often.
Like Christopher Reeves when he
fell off the horse.
Yes, apparently severed, I think. I don't know if that's a concussion or not.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holmes.
I would prefer to leave that out and leave that to the medical textbooks. They evolve, and if we write into statute what the definition is or isn't of a concussion and how it's caused and all that, it puts us into the middle of that. I'd rather leave that to the medical textbooks.
So we're all medical doctors.
Well, yay, I can sign MD after my name. MAJD, MD, I'll just keep, you know, what else can I do?
MD in chief, whatever else.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any other conversation among the committee members? We've been at this an hour and a half, thereabouts. Representative Thompson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move that CSHB 15 version B be advanced from committee with conceptual amendment number one and conceptual amendment number two with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Great. Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing none. This bill advances from committee. The brief at ease. House Joint Resolution 16, Representative Wes Keller proposing amendments to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to state aid for education. Representative Keller, still have version A in front of us here?
Judiciary Committee and Chairman Gatto, thank you for hearing the bill. I'm Wes Keller, District 14, and yes, we have District A, or I mean Section A, Version A. It's been one of those kind of days. Version
Are you a senator now, sir? From Southeast.
In front of us.
What happened?
From Southeast.
Well, okay. If Matsu keeps growing and Southeast keeps shrinking,
we may have to go
all the way to Metlakatla.
Okay. Take it over.
So, Representative Keller, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have testifiers online that I would like to leave time to speak, so I'll be pretty brief. The this resolution is about the Blaine Amendment and the history of the Blaine Amendment as it goes back to Ulysses S. Grant. About his time, I think it was a senator by the name of Blaine. It was as a result of a backlash at the time against the Catholic faith, and I think that is very well documented in history. There's very little dispute. I've never seen any that was the reason the Blaine Amendment was proposed. As it turns out, the Blaine Amendment never did pass the U.S. Senate, but as a result of it and the issue being at large, I believe it's 39 states. I'm hoping we have testimony online to correct me if I'm wrong on that, but a majority of states anyway have Blaine Amendments in their constitutions. It's a very brief bill. I would call your attention on page 1, lines 8 through 10. No money. The part that's deleted is that no money should be paid from public funds for the direct benefit of any religious or other private educational institution. And then it adds the sentence down on 14 and 15 where it's talking about tax and the money appropriated. Nothing in this section shall prevent payment from public funds for the direct educational benefit of students as provided by law. It's very brief. this bill, this resolution, it's in place. It goes side by side with HB 145, which is currently in the Education Committee. And if the committee chooses to move HGR 16 today, it will go to the Finance Committee, where it will wait until something happens with HB 145. HB 145, for those of you that may not have looked at it, is simply a law that says that a parent has the right to choose any school, public or private, and that public funds can follow the student for the benefit of the student to pay for that education. So that's what HB 145 does. Frankly, it's unconstitutional unless this resolution passes. Therefore, you have it in front of you. Also, I want to point out, though, that HGR 16 goes much farther than K-12. It's very significant in our post-secondary education systems. Sheldon Jackson, if you remember, which is no longer there, I believe that it's very possible that if this amendment had been made, it would still be with us because no money could go there to help out. I just very briefly just want to put on the record that the process for the amendment of a constitution is incredibly valuable and very significant in the United States of America. As a matter of fact, we forget, you know, some of the most significant things about our constitution are seem a little trite, but the amendment process is incredibly important because it's we the people, blah 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 blah, you know, the whole thing's there, and it's irrevocable, and the only way it can be changed is back to the sovereignty of the people. So the process that was laid down in both our Constitution and the U.S. Constitution to amend it is incredibly significant, incredibly valuable to us, and right up there along with some of the other things that came along with the United States of America, like presidentialism and judicial review, and another thing, just the fact that it was a printed constitution. In the past, before we came along, constitutions were more traditional, common law type things. We came along, we put it on a brief piece of paper. So my point is that the amendment process is incredibly important. We can't change the amendment as legislators. The Constitution gives us our job, defines it very carefully, and it leaves the changing of the Constitution in the hands of the people. Therefore, I would ask the committee, please pass this resolution so we can get it to the point where the Alaskan people can make a change if it is appropriate. With that, I'll stop because I know there's other testifiers, and respond to any questions you might have.
Quite a few. Committee members, I have some public testimony we need to get to. Is there anything you want to say before we do that? Okay. John Alcantara, why don't you come forward?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is John Alcantara. Served Government Relations Director for 13,000 public school employee members of NEA Alaska, from Metlakatla to Barrow and most points in between. I'm also a parent of four children, including three kids, which are attending public school in the MATSU and receiving a great education. Interesting stat in MATSU schools that I just recently found out is the three largest high schools, Colony, Wassel, and Palmer High, have a graduation rate of 87, 84, and 77% respectively. I thought that was a nice statistic to point out when there are issues that I see as kind of against
in the
public
order
school.
Of Colony, Wassel, Palmer?
Colony, Wassel, Palmer, yes, sir. And yes, I'm from Palmer. So, basically, I'm here today to inform this committee that the members of NEA Alaska strongly oppose HCR 16. I guess the representative from Wasilla and District 14 has done a good job of kind of laying out the process by which a constitution can be changed, and I guess I applaud him for that, to kind of lay out the process. You know, NEA Alaska has met with the supporters of HGR 16, aforementioned legislation of HB 145. While the interaction was quite pleasant, it was pointed out to them the legislation and any real voucher proposals that passed, and I guess from talking to other people, one man's vouchers is another man's scholarships or other vernacular. But, you know, it's basically pointed out this legislation does not ensure religious or private schools will take all Alaska's children, does not ensure teachers are certified, would not ensure the same testing requirements that public schools go through. It was interesting in the previous committee that the principal administrator of Cook Inlet Academy from Soldotna, another place where I used to live, she pointed out very frankly that, no, they would not accept all students because they just don't have the facilities or the staff to do so, and that there is indeed a statement of faith that's required to attend some private and religious schools. You know, I think with vouchers, most children will get left behind. And public schools make a commitment to all of our children, regardless of their background, learning capabilities, and private schools simply do not. And because 90% of Alaska's children, including my own, attend public schools, I think education reform efforts should focus on the schools that benefit the majority of the children. You know, vouchers are not a guarantee of acceptance in the private school of your choice. Matter of fact, with vouchers, it's not really the parents that choose, it's the private schools that choose. And I think, indeed, it's the fallacy of any voucher-type legislation. You know, I probably could go on, but I guess I just want to point out the real matter I think committee should be discussing is real education reform. And I would say that those would include high-quality early education so every child arrives at school ready to learn, providing more quality tutoring and mentoring, and increasingly encouraging parental involvement through regular parent-teacher conferences and better communication between teachers and to help improve student achievement. I don't think HDR 16 is a good idea. Neither do the members of NEA Alaska. It's been attested to at our delegate assembly, and for those who aren't aware, this year was the 55th annual NEA Alaska Delegate Assembly. Interestingly, it goes back to the same Constitutional Convention of 55 and 56, where Alaskans spent 75 days in Fairbanks, and truth be told, I think did a incredible job and put forward probably the best constitution in the United States. And I say that somewhat, you know, obviously as a lifelong born and raised Alaskan whose father worked for Governor Bill Egan, who obviously led that Constitutional Convention. So I think they did a great job. I certainly don't think this part of the Constitution needs to ever be changed, and we of NEA Alaska oppose HDR 16.
Did you say ever? How many delegates in NEA Alaska?
Thank you for asking that question. 400 delegates elected by the 13,000 members.
And there is a convention, and these delegates essentially, do they poll their members before showing up at delegate assembly, or do they go on their gut feeling that this is what their members prefer?
Great question, Mr. Chairman. They are elected by the members for their individual local school districts and then local associations. And of the, it's actually about 450 spots, and those folks then set the public policy for NEA Alaska for the year. It meets the very last weekend in January. I sort of compare it to the legislature on steroids because at the Hotel Captain Cook in Anchorage, the few places that can hold it. And I kind of refer to it as the legislature on steroids because adjournment this year was at 1:12 a.m. And those who have been in this body for any length of time can remember 1:12 a.m. or later adjournments of your body. But they are elected to set the policy. So, no, there's not a poll of all 13,000 members. It's the people that are elected, like in a democratic process. They're elected. They represent the folks from their area. And they set our policy for the year and give me my marching orders to come down here and testify for and against legislation.
And another question, if this constitutional amendment were to pass, would that not result in less money for each of the public schools?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it would result in significantly less money for public schools. I mean, it's I've sat through some of the testimony. It's been a good learning process for me to sit through some of the testimony in the previous committee. I believe percentages were not so out of whack with what happens now, around 5 or 10% in different locales where they've had vouchers. Milwaukee was mentioned in some other places, but certainly it resources for public education, really in every state, are scarce, and I think this would result in resources that should go to improve public education going to private or religious schools.
And would you oppose the resolution if we were to make up for the loss of revenue?
I think just on the morals of the Constitution, I think we would oppose any any resolution that puts it towards private religious schools.
Got it. Questions from Representative Keller?
Yeah. John, thanks for your testimony, and I respect your position on this, but I just wanted to clarify and make really sure that I understand. You don't have any problem with this going before the people to decide, do you? I mean, you're saying you're against it. I understand that, and NEA is against it, but what would be your, if you are, I mean, why would you not want the people of the state of Alaska to be able to make this choice on their constitution?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, that's a very interesting question. I mean, I guess I was a little perplexed to see the resolution move forward without the legislation. And when I read it and it talks about benefit of students as provided by law, I mean, I look at it in my own way of, you know, being in Juneau since 1984 and being in Alaska since 1964, of maybe putting the cart before the horse. I actually think this probably shouldn't go forward absent the, I guess, companion vehicle, if you will. That's the piece of legislation to change the law. Enabling legislation. Thank you for that right term. Thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a point on that if this were to pass, it would definitely go in front of the people, but the Constitution also gives the legislature a role to play in vetting things before they go. There's a dual role in constitutional amendments. One part is to be played by the legislature in initially vetting, and then the other part is to be played by the people. So this is part of the way the Constitution laid it out, is for us to vet them first as well. So,
and in the election pamphlet, there's a page for pro and a page for con. I think that is guaranteed for every single constitutional amendment. Representative Gruenberg?
If I may respond to Representative Keller.
Oh, thank you. If I may respond to Representative Keller, the way the constitutional amendment articles are written, it's opposite the way the federal constitution is amended. Only a majority of each house in federal constitution need pass it to the states, but two-thirds of the states, or the people, have to ratify it. It's exactly the opposite here. It's a much higher threshold to get it to the people, and then only a sheer majority plus one need approve it. So that shows to me that the way our constitution is set up put much more weight on the legislature in proposing a constitution than on the people in ratifying it. And so it's exactly the opposite policy as the federal constitution.
Representative Keller?
There are aspects of the process that are clearly opposite, and your point is well taken. However, to say exactly opposite would also imply that the constitution is, you know, lesser sovereignty goes to the people themselves. In other words, what I'm saying is the ultimate principle is not opposite. Both the U.S. Constitution and the state constitution, the ultimate sovereignty goes back to the people of Alaska. And so while I concede your point that the processes are different and the legislature has more weight, it's still very, very significant that the people are the ones that make the changes.
And through the chair, I would concede your point as well.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson?
Yes. Well, I don't have any questions for Mr. Contra. No. I had a question for the...
We have some
people. Let me get back to committee.
People in both. Three people in Anchorage, one in Valdez, and one off net that want to testify. I'd like to give them a chance so we can at least get their testimony on the record. Mayor Tom Fink, are you online?
Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Here.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record and then give us your testimony.
Okay. Tom Fink, I represent myself. I'm here today to endorse House Joint Resolution 16 and hope that you pass it out shortly. I think our current Blaine Amendment is very discriminatory and inappropriate and ought to go. But, of course, my main thrust is I am supporting HB 145, and this constitutional amendment is undoubtedly required if House Bill H 145 is to become effective. There is a problem with education, and the problem isn't just throwing more money at it. And that's the answer we get from the existing status quo. We need opportunity, and what 145 does, it says a parent can pick the school, the government money follows, no restrictions beyond existing laws having to do with private schools. We think a parent has the right, we think he has the obligation to raise his kids and see that they get a good education. Now, the concept of education is fine, you know, a lot of people would disagree with Mr. Alcantara. As late as last week, some task force from the legislature or the governor's office reported in the Daily News to the task force, last paragraph, the report cites a University of Alaska estimate that on the average, half of first-time freshmen in the system need remedial English or math classes between 2005 and 2010. That's an indictment of our K-12 system. We believe that if parents have the choice, and currently, you know, they have the choice, but they really don't because they can't afford it. On a national basis, it's stated that 1 in 10 parents can afford a private education. Everybody pays taxes, but if you go to a government school, you get a free school. If you go to a private school or a religious school, you got to pay all over again. It's inequitable. It's wrong. It's discrimination based upon a parent's choice, either having to do with religion or some other aspect, maybe skiing or vocational education, whatever it happens to be. It's unjust and ought to be changed. 145 opens a whole avenue for parents to find what it takes to make their kids learn. And each kid is different. They're not all the same. We have this monopoly of education that isn't going to improve. The people who control the monopoly don't want changes. There's a lot of opportunity out there, and we ought to allow the parents to take advantage of it. And that means that government money has to follow, and that means that this amendment has to pass. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Mayor. Next, David Boyle. Are you also in Anchorage?
Yes, I am, Chairman Gatto.
Put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chairman Gatto, committee members, my name is David Boyle, and I'd like to testify as an Alaskan citizen today on HJR 16, the constitutional amendment to the Alaska Constitution.
David, do you have any affiliation at all? Are you working for some group or representing anyone besides yourself?
No, I am a volunteer, however, with the Alaska Policy Forum, a free market think tank here in Alaska.
Okay.
However,
okay.
I am not speaking for them. I am speaking as an individual.
Good. That helps. Go ahead.
Sure. Chairman Gatto, as background, Alaska has what is called a Blaine Amendment in its constitution, which precludes state funds going to private and religious schools. This Blaine Amendment has a very, very shady history, named after U.S. Congressman James Blaine. These amendments were passed as a direct result of the anti-immigrant, particularly Irish, and I am Irish, anti-Catholic bigotry that was dominant in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Many states were required to include Blaine amendments in their constitutions before they were allowed to join the Union. This was called the Enabling or Inclusion Act of 1889. This is why many Western states today have Blaine amendments in their state constitutions, including Alaska. However, the U.S. Supreme Court laid the constitutionality of the Blaine amendments to rest in the Zelman versus Simmons-Harris case of 2002. This decision stated that the Federal Establishment Clause is not violated by the participation of religious schools and school choice programs. Students in Cleveland, Ohio, were given state vouchers to attend the school of their choice, religious or sectarian or non-sectarian. religious and non-religious schools could participate in this voucher program. Over 60% of the students who participated in this Cleveland program were at or below the poverty line and thus could not afford private schools otherwise. The Supreme Court held that this government aid reaches religious institutions only by way of deliberate choices of numerous individual recipients. That is, it was incidental. Chief Justice Rehnquist stated that the court had rejected similar challenges three times. In August of 2002, the State of Washington Blaine Amendment was struck down by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals by a vote of 2-1. This decision was based on, quote, a state law may not offer a benefit to all, but exclude some on the basis of religion. This is the Davy versus Locke case of 2002. The Supreme Court made clear, since Blaine amendments, quote, have been linked with anti-Catholicism, end quote, they are unique creatures that merit especially close examination. In addition, under the Individuals with Disabilities Act, the IDEA Act, or special ed, the federal government gives funds to provide special education to children with disabilities. It requires districts spend some of these funds for children whose parents choose private, including religious schools. On April 4th, 2011, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a 5-4 decision that the Arizona Tuition Tax Credit Plan was constitutional. The majority wrote, quote, awarding some citizens a tax credit allows other citizens to retain control over their own funds in accordance with their own consciences. Justice Kennedy said, the plaintiff's position assumes that income should be treated as if it were government property, even if it has not come into the tax collector's hands. That was Arizona Christian School Tuition versus Wynn. Also, Congress and President Obama just signed into law the new D.C. Opportunity Scholarship Program, now called SOAR, S-O-A-R, as of April 8th this year, with a continuing resolution. Our federal tax dollars, yours and mine, are used to allow District of Columbia parents to opt out of a failing educational system and take these dollars, our federal tax dollars, to any school, private, charter. I ask that you pass H.J.R. 16 out of committee and let the people of Alaska decide. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Okay, Mr. Boyle, appreciate that. We only have two more. We're going to hang in here. Bob Flint, also in Anchorage, and then I'm going to get to Kathleen and Valdez. So hang in there. Bob Flint.
My name is Flint. I'm representing myself. I've been in Alaska since 1963. I have four children. The three older ones all went through the Anchorage School District, both the optional and regular programs, and my adopted daughter graduated from Inlet View in the school system and is now at a small private high school. My experience is, I hear, of course, many parents or any parents who have at least more than one children is that one size doesn't fit all, of course, and some children are more difficult to fit in a system than the other. So I view this type of system as a help to the parents and students to get the education that fits them, and the duty, as expressed in the Constitution, of public education is really educating the student rather than an institutional requirement. I do not absolutely view this as in any way an attack or a detriment on the public school system, which will always remain the normal and dominant way that people are educated in this state, as my children certainly were. I think that any issue of educational reform is an entirely independent issue. If there are reforms necessary, they should go forward and be discussed regardless of whether this issue is on the table or not. I think it is, as far as putting to the vote of the people where it has to go, I think it's worthy of that level of public discussion. It's a national issue in many other states, and I think probably most of you noticed that in the last minute continuing resolution keeping the government, the federal government, going, they reinstated the District of Columbia program that had been dropped about a year ago. So I think it is a worthy issue before the public, and have all voices discuss it the way democratic decisions should be made. And I thank you very much.
Thanks. lastly, we have Kathleen Todd in Valdez. Are you there, Kathleen? Kathleen Todd?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Okay, Kathleen Todd, I am on the Valdez School Board, but I'm speaking as an individual. I've been in Alaska for 30 years. I have two children who graduated from the Valdez public schools, except that one of them finished at a private school. I am against House Bill 145 and the Joint Resolution 16. I think that House Bill 145 would create chaos in the school system and be a detriment to a lot of kids. But speaking to House Joint Resolution 16 specifically, I think that this would allow a draw on public funds for private purposes without any restriction on what's taught or whether there's any success in teaching it. That's the way that that House bill is written. It's been said that a good, probably a good test of separation of church and state sorts of things is to imagine that your enemy got this benefit, not that you or your friends got this benefit. So would you feel good about having your public funds supporting a school that teaches jihad and the Quran as the only thing that they teach in their school? Would you be good with your tax dollars going into to state funding for schools that differentiate between what boys are taught and what girls are allowed to be taught? Would you like to fund schools that refuse to accept students with disabilities or behavior problems and leave those for the public schools? I have problems with all of those things, and I don't want my public funds going into those, just like there may be some people who don't want their public funds going into funding abortions or whatever. It's exactly the same sort of thing. There's also a point, even if the schools were not, were somehow required to teach the main subjects, and this money only went to those main subjects, there's also a problem in not educating students together. You could imagine that we have people over in this corner being taught one thing, people over in this corner not being taught another thing, and they never interact with each other whatsoever. Remember that being educated together and not separated by ideology and religion is one of the things that's made this country great. Look at some places in Europe where that hasn't happened. One of the previous speakers was asked why not just put this to the constitutional amendment to the people. How can you be against that? It sounds a little bit like the person who's asking me to sign their petition outside the post office. That's where we sign petitions in Valdez. And, and I know you're against this, but of course you want the people to vote on it, don't you? That's a cop-out. You should decide what you think at the time. And I was very, I appreciated the previous speaker who said that in Alaska, it's two-thirds of the legislature has to decide before it's only half of the people. That means that you guys have the responsibility. This is an issue that is very prone to sound bites. And aren't you for choice? Of course you're for choice, aren't you? Without describing the rest of what would happen if this passes. I think that those of you who are saying, well, we'll just pass it to the people, need to carefully uphold the responsibility to analyze all the ramifications and to not just put it to the people without thinking it all the way through. I urge you to vote no on House Joint Resolution 16. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. That I don't have anyone else who wants to speak on this issue. Is there anyone online that so I get the indication no one is online? Anyone in the audience? With that, we'll close public testimony. Brings it back to the committee. Representative Keller, did you want to respond to some of the comments that were made?
Oh, just very briefly, HGR 16 is not HB 145. Very different. Very different. Yes, they are compatible. They are supplemental. There's a lot of policy that has to be hammered out in how HB 145. Just one comment. If parent, the HB 145 is about parental choice. And the parents choosing where they want to have their children educated. And I would propose that if there were parents that wanted to send their children to an Islamic school, that is completely consistent both with the values of this country and with the intent of the bill. It's an issue of, it isn't just a soundbite to say that it's about school choice. It really is.
And they have to meet standards if they're a school.
And that's the other place I was going to go. You made the previous testifier there commented on if they only taught jihad, they have to do other things too, and that they have requirements to keep track of where they're, what their children are taught and how they're performing in the area of math, grammar, spelling, and what am I leaving out?
Reading, writing, math, and problem solving.
Right, right. So, I mean, it couldn't, they would be free to teach from the Quran, but they would also have to produce certain levels of performance.
You know, just for the record, my parents put me in St. Joseph's Elementary School, and the alternative was Public School 1, PS1, and they did it so I would get a better education. It was the thing they wanted to do for me. I hope it worked out, but it seems to be at least okay. People don't go to a public school that's a religious school so they can have exposure to religion, always, certainly most of the time, but not necessarily all of the time. So I think what Representative Keller is trying to do is open it up to people who might be Jewish to go to Manonouska Christian School. It'd be okay if that was the best school around, and they would want to do that. So that's my input. Any other person want to speak? Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I agree with you. Most of my friends' kids who go to religious schools, actually a lot of them, my father was first of all raised by the Jesuits. He went to Jesuit school all the way K through 12 in his first year of college. You know, I like to think my father's an intelligent, well-educated man. I have lots of... Yeah. Would you second my opinion, Mr. Chairman?
Good.
Pretty good? Yeah. That's what I say most of the time, pretty good.
Likes his daughter, anyway.
he does, Mr. Chairman. He's my biggest cheerleader. And it is... I always find it mildly amusing that most of my friends who send their kids to various religious schools actually don't necessarily even belong to the religion. I have a lot of friends who send their kids to Jewish schools and none of them are Jewish. Other friends send their kids to Catholic schools and they aren't Catholic, and they do it as was said because they think their kids are going to get a better education. So I am in no way, shape, or form against private schools, whether they are secular or religious. I think that I am a big believer in school choice. I went through optional programs and traditional, all public schools myself in K through 12, but I went through both the optional programs and the regular programs. I think choice is an excellent thing. However, my concern comes when we start diverting funds, which I believe it would be the outcome of this, diverting funds from the public schools into the private schools. And so, although I am a big believer in choice in education, I'm going to do not pass on this bill.
Representative Thompson?
Yes, I'm not exactly sure of where I'm headed with this, but where the school funding formula comes down, shouldn't there be a fiscal note in here? Because you're going to take away the funding for private schools, does that open it up to where the Department of Education in the state is going to be paying out more money into these individual communities where there's a private school?
Is that not with the enabling legislation? This is simply a vote of the people to
right.
authorize it.
Okay.
Well, to respond to that, HB 145 does have a fiscal note. Yes, it would expand the amount of money we spend in education to include the parents that are now paying double.
Yes.
They're paying for their taxes and they're paying for tuition.
So, yes, there's a very significant fiscal note attached to HB 145, although the details of it are far from being reached because it's narrowing down specifically how that will work. So
it's the same number of students, it's going to different schools, and it generates a fiscal note?
Two quick comments. I know we're short on time, but it'd be new children that would be paid for from state funds because they are the ones that are currently attending the private school. There is very, very significant and consistent evidence that it does not hurt, does not harm the private public school either in performance or in loss of students. And there's 19 empirical studies out there that I can supply you with. They're in the packet for HB 145 if you want to see them. But it always works out better. The performance goes up because of the benefit of the life and the competition. So.
Okay. Representative Thompson?
Nope,
I'm done. We're done? Well, since I've kept you about 10 minutes late, why don't we bring this to a vote? Is there someone who wants to move the bill forward?
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that House Bill or House Joint Resolution 16, version 27-LS0024/A, advanced from committee with committee recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
We have an objection, Representative Holmes.
No objection. Okay.
So we have an objection. Susan, would you call the roll?
Representative Pruitt.
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
No.
Representative Holmes.
No.
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Keller.
Yes.
Representative Chenault is not present. Representative Gatto.
Well, he's normally not present.
He's not on the committee.
So I'll just voice my yes vote, and we won't count him as a no vote. So by a vote of 5-2, House Joint Resolution 16 moves from committee. Thank you so much. We are adjourned.
Is he an official alternate?